Politik needs votes. Politik needs your mind. Politik needs human beings. Politik needs lives.
Welcome back. This is Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and joining us now is Gordon Chang, author of Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World, and The Coming Collapse of China. He lived and worked in China and Hong Kong for almost two decades and is a writer, lawyer, and international policy analyst who has given briefings at the National Intelligence Council, the Central Intelligence Agency, the State Department, and the Pentagon. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gordon Chang.
Thank you very much.
And this mysterious death of the 41-year-old British businessman that is now being pinned on the wife of a rising political star in China, a member of the Politburo, who is now, of course, being disgraced because of his wife's alleged activities. What do you make of it? Is this some kind of political vendetta and this instance being used against him? Or is it possible that this wife, who was a lawyer, murdered this British businessman?
It's possible that Bo Xilai's wife, Gu Kailai, did indeed order the murder of Neil Hayward, the British businessman. And it's also possible that this charge is being used against Bo Xilai by his political enemies. The problem right now is that senior leaders at the top of the Communist Party in China are fighting among themselves, and they are using anything at their disposal. So what we have is a bare-knuckled, no-rules type of political struggle of the type that we saw three, four decades ago in China.
Well, there's another aspect to the story, though, Gordon Chang, that's fascinating. Wang Lijun, who is a close aide to Mr. Bo, and he was himself under investigation of corruption, he fled to the consulate of the United States in Chengdu in February, where he spent more than 30 hours and handed over apparently a huge treasure trove of intelligence, but then subsequently was not granted asylum. So surely that has caused Mr. Bo some problems.
This is the incident that really started things off. At least this is the incident that brought this to the attention of the international community and to the Chinese themselves. Wang Lijun, who was the top cop in Chongqing, where Bo Xilai was the party secretary, in other words, the boss, Wang Lijun fled to Chengdu, which is the capital, Sichuan province, and tried to defect to the United States. And Bo essentially invaded Sichuan province with an army of hundreds of armed security troops. They surrounded the U.S. consulate, and eventually Wang ended up in the custody of the Ministry of State Security. He was whisked off to Beijing in a plane and has been himself under custody. And, of course, he's now been branded a traitor. As you pointed out, Bo Xilai has lost his party post. And so this is going to be a drama that will continue.
So what do you think, though? Bo was obviously doing damage control by surrounding the consulate. Why did the U.S. back down? Was it just the sheer intimidation of being surrounded? Because I'm trying to figure out now whether they found a way to get rid of an embarrassment here and pinned it on national security when it may have a lot more to do with criminality.
There are a lot of considerations going both ways. First of all, Wang Lijun was someone with blood on his hands, and it was not the type of person you'd like to grant asylum to. On the other hand, the United States very well may have should have granted asylum to him for a number of reasons. One of them is that we wanted to know what Wang knew. We wanted to perhaps unnerve the Chinese regime. I think one of the reasons why we didn't grant asylum to him was because we didn't want to roil the waters with China. Right on the eve of Vice President Xi Jinping's visit to Washington. But there are a lot of considerations going both ways. We are going to find out later the reasons why we didn't grant him refugee status or asylum. And there's going to be an argument over this because this is an extremely consequential decision. And I actually don't know whether we should or not, but nonetheless, there are a lot of reasons that people are going to argue over this for a long time to come.
Again, I'm speaking with Gordon Chang, author of Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World, and The Coming Collapse of China. He lived and worked in China and Hong Kong for almost two decades and is a writer, lawyer, and international policy analyst who has given briefings at the National Intelligence Council, the Central Intelligence Agency, the State Department, and the Pentagon. So let's turn then, you know, again, it seems to me that this story from the Chinese point of view is either about criminality, national security, or both. Would you agree?
Yes. There is so much going on right here. You know, in terms of criminality, the real issue is, yeah, Bo may have dirty hands, as Wang Lijun does, but so does virtually everybody else at the top of the Chinese political system. And now with the death of Neil Haywood, Bo actually has a corpse in his closet, but all the rest of the leaders have skeletons in theirs. And by really pushing Bo to the wall and giving him no graceful exit, he now has no reason to go into retirement quietly. And he knows where the skeletons are buried, and so he very well may try to out other leaders. And so this could get really, really ugly as time goes on. And the problem is that Bo does have a lot of allies left in China. He's got a lot of leftists, some elements of the military, people who respected his father, people that he's accumulated along the way of his long career. So there are a lot of people who are not happy with Bo being sidelined the way that he has. And so we could see this continue for quite some time, split the Communist Party open, and maybe even lead to the end of the People's Republic.
Well, of course, that's echoes of your book, The Coming Collapse of China, right? I mean, is this something you predicted?
No, I mean, nobody could have predicted this. And right. If you had scripted this and tried to sell it to Hollywood, you would have been run out of town. Virtually right. Every China watcher, those who are friendly with the regime and those who were not friendly, believe that the Communist Party had institutionalized itself and that this succession would be smooth, as the party's favorite word. Because they believe that the party had limits and guidelines and rules and all sorts of things that were to govern succession. But as it turned out, they didn't. And what we are seeing is raw political fighting. And it is of the type that people did not expect.
Well, Gordon Chang, it's been apparent for some time that you have this bifurcation in the Chinese government or leadership, I should say. You've got the Communist Party that really run the show, and then you've got a government structure that is trying to develop civil society, trying to develop law structures, you know, environmental protection, you name it. But at every turn, the Communist Party bosses throughout the entire system, the apparatchiks and the nomenklatura, I guess, can overrule the government at any turn. And it seems to me that this is the basic struggle going on within in China, isn't it, between a kind of mafia operation represented by the Communist Party and civil society represented by the Chinese government?
Well, you're absolutely right. China is a one-party system, and in those one-party systems, the government is subservient to the party. And that's why China's leader is not the president. China's leader is the party secretary, the general party secretary. And now both of those roles are in the hands of Hu Jintao. But it's always been clear that the party leads and the government follows. And that has been true from the founding of the People's Republic.
But this has led to a very corrupt clique, hasn't it, who are above the law?
China is perhaps as corrupt or more corrupt than it's ever been in its thousands of years of history. This reason is that there's now so much money that is floating around China, and the government and the party still make decisions that should be left to the market. So you have an unaccountable political system making decisions that the market should make. You have the two preconditions for corruption. And because of all the money sloshing around, China has become deeply, deeply corrupt.
Well, in the case of Bo and his wife, who now is in disgrace, and you were saying that he still has some chips to play, some cards up his sleeve, and presumably he's not going to be silenced totally, so he does have perhaps some access to the media to put his story on the record. This doesn't happen very often. I guess that the last time that I recall it happened was just before Tiananmen, wasn't it?
There have been political struggles in China at the top of the Communist Party, and of course the party did split in Tiananmen over those who wanted to talk to the protesters around China and those who wanted to use the military to suppress it. But we've had similar incidents with, for instance, Lin Biao, Mao Zedong's favorite general. And there have been and will continue to be, because this is a system where there is no rule of law, there is no constitution really to speak of, and that really when you have that type of situation, you're going to have these types of problems. This is the first leadership transition in the history of the People's Republic that has not been masterminded by Deng Xiaoping. You know, Deng got rid of Mao's designated successor, and then he chose Jiang Zemin to follow him, and then he chose Hu Jintao, the current leader, to follow Jiang. But Deng Xiaoping was in no position to choose Hu Jintao's successor, and so that's the reason why we're having a lot of fighting with no real group of elders to rein in the combatants.
But in terms of the corruption at the highest levels of the Communist Party of the People's Republic of China, you have surely essentially the princelings, the children, become the kind of cutouts for all of the corruption. I mean, it's not unheard of. Next door in Mexico, you know, the brother of the Salinas was the bag man. It happens throughout third world countries. But in the case of China, it seems like the princelings, the children, were the ones that are given the favored deals with the Western, big Western companies that come in there. And here you have an example with Mr. Bo, where the British businessman who was apparently either died of alcohol poisoning or was murdered by Mr. Bo's wife, or at least on her orders. Other Western businessmen in China apparently couldn't figure out why he was so rich. And apparently he was the cutout for the Bo family. He was the one that made their business deals and obviously kicked back a lot of money.
Well, it's not just the princelings who are on the take. It's also the other factions in the Communist Party. The China Youth League faction of Hu Jintao, the Shanghai gang of Jiang Zemin. These guys are all corrupt. And so, yeah, the princelings are corrupt, but it's not corruption is not limited to them. And that's why we have all of these incidents. And I think we're going to learn a lot more about it. And the Chinese people are just going to watch this with utter disgust. I mean, they were disgusted before the Wang Lijun incident. It's only going to get much worse.
So you believe that there is a kind of, within the Chinese people, a sense of revulsion at their leadership, that they lack legitimacy in their eyes?
I think that they do tend to have a legitimacy problem. You know, the Communist Party was legitimate when Mao Zedong was there because he represented, first of all, you know, the Chinese people standing up, his famous phrase, and also he represented an ideology, which we might not have liked, but it did, at least in its initial years, have legitimacy. When Deng Xiaoping got rid of a lot of the ideological baggage of Mao, he basically rested the party on two pillars. One of them is the continual delivery of prosperity, and the other one is nationalism. And now that the Chinese economy is having some very severe problems, it's growing only in the low single digits at the moment, that leaves only nationalism as a base of legitimacy for the party. And that means that all these problems that we see in Chinese society, and corruption is not the only one of them, it really erodes the not only the legitimacy of the party, but its ability to govern. So we're having all sorts of problems right now.
So, of course, we're having problems right here in Los Angeles, I might add. Just last night here in Los Angeles, two Chinese students were murdered at USC, and that's bound to create, I think, a tremendous backlash in China. And, of course, you know, it leads one to question our society in terms of public safety.
Well, yeah, every society has problems, and the deaths of two people are certainly unfortunate. But in our society, there are ways, there are rules. You know, people can be brought to justice before courts that are as impartial as they possibly can be. There's a constitution to work out these problems. You know, in the United States, we had the issues in the 2000 election. And it was messy as it was, this matter got to the Supreme Court. We had a Supreme Court decision, Bush v. Gore, and it was followed. And this fascinated the Chinese people, that there could be a judicial resolution of essentially an unsolvable political problem. You can't have that in China because you don't have the rule of law. You don't have independent courts. You don't have independent prosecutors. And that's why these Chinese political problems can get out of bounds really fast. So that's why there are so many problems right now in Chinese society, because you don't have the mechanisms to intermediate social discontent. The only way the Communist Party can deal with these problems is not inspire people anymore, but just to coerce them. And that's not a long-term solution.
Well, it looks like the kids that were killed, the two engineering students, came from wealthy families. They were driving an expensive BMW, which may have been the reason for the attack. It may have been a carjacking. But let's broaden it out a little and go back to another area that you've covered, Gordon Chang, and that is North Korea. It looks like they showed a Western delegation were seen the fueling of a rocket that's supposed to launch a satellite, and they showed the satellite, which looked like sort of 1950s technology. But the long and the short of it is there is also rumors that there's going to be another nuclear test in the next weeks or so. What's your understanding?
It looks like there is going to be a missile launch within hours. And we have to go back to both 2006 and 2009 when North Korea tested long-range missiles. They followed those missile tests with nuclear detonations. So we can expect a nuclear detonation pretty soon. South Korean intelligence has spotted dirt being removed from a tunnel, which is a site of the previous nuclear detonation. So we can expect essentially that there will be a third test of not only a long-range missile, but also a third detonation of a nuclear weapon in the very near future.
So just in closing, Gordon Chang, you've also been covering the North Korean gulag, which the North Koreans deny there is such a thing as political prisoners, but we getting an awful lot of reporting from North Koreans who escape into China and those that are captured and what happens to their relatives back home. And apparently a lot of North Koreans risk a regular run where they go in to China to get foodstuffs because of the starvation inside China and trade what they can and come back in. And that's considered criminal activity that results in them being sent to the gulags. One of the things I find extraordinary about covering North Korea is that a lot of the resistance to believing what's going on inside North Korea comes from South Koreans. They simply don't believe a lot of what is reported in the Western press.
Well, they don't want to believe. Many of them don't, because they want to believe that they are a Korean nation and that Koreans would never do this to each other. And if they were to believe those things, they'd have to come to some stark conclusions about the nature of the regime in Pyongyang. And that would really mean that they could not essentially pursue their progressive agenda. There is a gulag in North Korea. It houses somewhere between 154,000 prisoners. That's according to the Seoul government, up to perhaps as many as 200,000. That comes from the State Department. But this is a network of prisons, political prisons, penitentiaries, police detention facilities, mobile forced labor brigades, where you have people being held and brutalized and starved for crimes that aren't crimes.
Well, Gordon Chang, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Gordon Chang, who's the author of Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World, and The Coming Collapse of China. He lived and worked in China and Hong Kong for almost two decades and is a writer, lawyer, and international policy analyst who has given briefings at the National Intelligence Council, the Central Intelligence Agency, the State Department, and the Pentagon. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.